Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
Look, Australia probably, I mean, we're fond of saying we punch above our weight, don't we, in things. We probably punch above our weight when it comes to global research too. Education and the quality of education in Australia is one of its major national assets. We ought to be cherishing it. Our research funding system, though, is so complex and unwieldy that many university researchers are just leaving the sector altogether. And many describe the system as broken. Others, well, would say it's in need of urgent reform. How do we keep some of our best research brains in the country? We're going to have a look at that question tonight. It's critical for Australia because if we don't, because we're very familiar with the stories, of course, of inventions or research or fundamental research that was done here, and yet it was capitalised on elsewhere. Solar panel research, for example, is a classic of technology and research breakthroughs that were simply exported to China. Now, why do we do these things? We're going to investigate that question tonight. In early September, Education Minister Jason Clare announced a review of the Australian Research Council, the ARC. Today was the day in which many ARC grants were announced. It's always a day in which there's a combination of hand-wringing, misery and some elation for a very few, of course, who succeed. We'll find out what that review might look like. 6 months into the new Labor government, what plans are afoot for Australia's research funding system and how can it be streamlined so that early and mid-career researchers can get their projects funded? Obviously not everybody, but at the moment the amount of form filling and report writing and endless back and forthing on research grant applications means that many academics feel like they're spending at least half their time writing research grant applications, with little chance of success. If you're an early or mid-career researcher and you've tried to get funding for your work, I would love you to call me 1300 800 222. Tell me about your experience. If you are successful, you might like to give me a call as well. Joining us tonight, two foot soldiers, I suppose, from the trenches of the funding and the grant application wars. Duncan Iveson's the Professor of Political Philosophy at the University of Sydney, former Deputy Vice-Chancellor, and is with us here in the studio. Duncan, good evening to you.
Hi, Phil. Good to be here.
Yeah, lovely to have your time and experiences too to bring to bear. Sue Bennett's also with us, the Dean of Arts and Social Science at the University of Wollongong. Sue, good evening to you.
Hello, it's lovely to be with you.
Yes, no, terrific to have both of you with us tonight. Duncan, maybe you can start with you. Can you give us a bare bones explanation on just how the research funding system works in Australia?
So the government spends about $12 billion a year on the sort of system as a whole, but only about $2.5 billion of that is actual funding for researcher-led projects. And of that, only about half of that, a bit less than half of that, is really on basic research, the research that really is the source of all the great discoveries, the great breakthroughs, and also better understanding of the world we're living in. So there's, and that funding has been fairly stagnant for quite a long period of time. There's been some new money, but it's been mainly in the applied end. So there's sort of two basic forms of research. Basic research, where you're asking questions about fundamental issues, whether in the humanities, social sciences, or physics or medical sciences, and then more applied research, where you're taking your discoveries and then seeing how you can apply them in the world in some way. And then at the further end of that is actually more industry or community-based research, where you're working with a partner. So Australia has a funding system which has been pretty much left to stagnate in terms of funding, and also it's been heavily politicized, right? So we've had ministers coming in and picking winners and losers, deciding what's good, what's bad.
Well, and also rubbishing researchers.
Sure, sure.
And we've had some pretty depressing senior cabinet ministers who rubbish the work of researchers and trivialize, you know, research grant applications and so on.
Correct. And so you've had a fairly politicized funding system as well. And that sends all kinds of confused signals to researchers, but also I think it really undermines the integrity of the system if you allow it to go on too far. So I think the problem with the Australian funding system fundamentally is we need to ask what the purpose, you know, what is research good for? Why are we doing it? And let's design a system on the basis of those fundamental purposes that we all agree on. It's become too fragmented and a bit too politicized.
Just looking at the pot itself, the pot of money itself, how does Australia compare here? How much do we spend on research compared to, I mean, we'd like to compare ourselves to, you know, to European countries to sure. the United States. We'd like to compare ourselves these days, I suspect, with a lot of Asian countries as well.
Sure, sure.
And we like to think we're clever.
Right. Well, we are. I mean, we've got a fantastic researcher. So let's not confuse the problems of the research system with our wonderful research community. I mean, amazing, amazing people. We're very lucky, very fortunate. One way to judge this is to look at what we think of as the amount of your gross domestic product. That is, when you look at the economy as a whole, how much are we devoting to research as a country? We are way, way down the list of our OECD partners. That is, the big developed economies. Hmm. More importantly, we're way, way down the list of countries that we often like to compare ourselves to. You know, we invest, you know, half as much as Israel does, half as much probably as the U.S. does.
Really?
Much less than South Korea does. Frankly, much less than China does, but the numbers in China are always hard to be clear about.
What about very small countries like Singapore?
Well, I mean, Singapore, the absolute numbers, again, they are out-investing us by a long shot.
Really?
Both at the basic end and in the more sort of commercially oriented end as well.
What about the United States?
Much, much less, about half as much as the U.S. does in terms of the of GDP. So, and then we
look—that's just dumb, isn't it?
Well,
or
is it? It's drifted slowly down over the years. It used to be we were a bit more competitive 10 years ago when there was some genuine new investment in the system, but we've allowed actually our system to become increasingly driven by universities finding their own resources to fund research. Just to give you an example, so University of Sydney, for every dollar of research that we gain from the ARC or from the National Health and Medical Research Council, we have to find another $1.50 to support it. Now, where do we get that other $1.50? From tuition fees.
Chinese students.
Well, from any number of places, right?
Well, I mean, this is half the reason behind, and it's a much misunderstood thing, isn't it, behind the way that universities went and chased overseas students, because with the withdrawal of the federal government out of university funding, you had to find the money from somewhere. And
sure.
This was one way to find it.
Sure. I mean, look, I have a more positive view. I mean, it's not sort of chasing the dollar. I mean, Australian universities are very entrepreneurial. I mean, you're right. We've had to work hard to find additional revenue. But you're right. That means that we haven't had that kind of core funding that really drives, you know, high quality funding systems. And that means then that you have these situations where in some of our funding programs, the success rate is less than 10%. That's less than 1 in 10 people getting a grant.
So let's bring you in here, Sue Bennett. Sue's the Dean of Arts and Social Science at the University of Wollongong. I want to explore how we can fix this in a moment, because I just want to get some dimension on the problem. What Duncan was just saying, Sue, that the success rate's about 10%. What's your perspective on that?
Well, the success rate has been declining for some time, and now we're at the point of 10%. I think when I talk to colleagues, they variously describe it as a lottery. And I think that's that feeling that the chance is so low of being successful. Mm. From my own time assessing grants and participating in the panel that recommends grants to the minister, it's very clear that the money runs out long before the quality does. So we go down a ranked list of just excellent applications, and you get to a point where you wish there was more money, because you can see that below that cutoff line, there's work that is high quality, it's cutting edge, it's proposed by incredibly capable researchers and teams of researchers. And what will happen for them is that they will have an unsuccessful outcome, like many colleagues would have had today, and they'll make a decision about whether they're prepared to rework that and put it in again. And across your career, I've been very fortunate to have attracted funding, but alongside that are a lot of unsuccessful attempts. And each time it's dispiriting. And I think for younger researchers, as you were saying, if you're looking at these kinds of success rates, you'll be wondering about whether this is even something that you want to begin to attempt to do.
Mm. Yeah, because every time I've talked to, and you know, we make it called START, 1-300-800-222, by the way, is the line. There are lines free if you would like to join this conversation. Sue, every time I talk to people who've applied for ARC, this is the Australian Research Council's application grant process. The process is extraordinarily onerous. You might think the university researchers are busy, you know, with their test tubes and graphs and testing new drugs and social researchers are conducting groundbreaking research in the effects of pandemics and so on and so forth. Well, they are, but many of them, Sue, are locked away for months on end writing these grant applications, aren't they? The process seems to be almost a job in itself.
It is, and there is this cycle. There is a bit of a treadmill, and for many of us, particularly the summer period, is the grant writing season, and it's often the time we're saying to our families, we're really sorry, we're going to have to balance spending some holiday time with you as well as getting some grant writing done. And then, as soon as you find out, colleagues have just found out now that perhaps they've been unsuccessful, and so they're making a decision, am I going to invest this consolidated time in the summer period to get this up and going again and reapply? So while you are carrying out the research that you're doing, you're constantly working out where the next application is going to go. And, of course, these are also these are collaborative. Teams put these in. So then you're working with other people. So you're doing that consultation. You may be bringing in a partner or partners. So you begin all of that work many, many months before you actually can submit the application. So there's a huge amount of lead time that goes in. The applications themselves are very complex with multiple parts, down to, budgets that are extremely detailed.
Does anyone actually read all this stuff? I mean, some of these applications are hundreds of pages. Does anyone don't tell me seriously, because I don't believe it, that anyone sits down and reads what would be a garage full of paper.
Phil, if I can jump, I mean, that's the other burden on the system, right? They are being read by other academics, people like Sue and others and myself who sit on assessment committees and who assess applications. So there's a huge burden of work, which, by the way, is being done as part of their day job, academics among everything else and other assessors. So people do read them. But as Sue said, they're complex documents. And having assessed for Canadian, European, and North American funding agencies, the ARC and HMRCs are among the more complex documents that you see in the research system.
So if Australia has a good global reputation for the standard of research, some might say, well, the system can't be that bad if we're actually batting above the average. But is that just Australian hubris, Duncan?
No, look, I mean, there's no question that the ARC and the NHMRC and the other funding agencies are funding good work. I mean, like I said, there's fantastic research quality in Australia. We attract and produce a lot of fantastic researchers. So there's good work being done in Australia. The challenge we've got, as I said, is that the system is the funding levels are fairly stagnant. There has been some new money, but it's been very much at the sort of applied commercial end, and we're starving that basic discovery end of research. The other thing is that, as I said, the system is quite fragmented. Different ministers come in, different governments come in and poke away at different parts of the system, and that makes for an additional complication for researchers. So now we're anticipating what we think governments will want or not want. So as I said, it's become a bit politicized. I think we've really got to ask, what is the fundamental purpose? What do we want from our research system, and how can we design it to deliver that?
Yeah. So why do you think it's become so politicized? Over the years, you get various government ministers saying, we should only be indulging in research that will produce some practical benefit. So, the money should be going to a better variety of wheat, or, a better yielding potato, or a better computer chip. Not that we make computer chips here anyway, but that all of this airy-fairy research into climate change, for example, has got to be stopped. The trouble with this whole process is that it's got caught up in the political debates of the day?
Well, I think the political dimension is one side of it. And I think back to the year that we actually had successful grants being announced in electorates, which I think I'm going to say was, I think, a particular
low point
in the politicisation. And you know what, Duncan says is right, because there's a big large section of these grants where you need to be able to explain what the benefit is and what's the benefit to Australia for funding this research. Mm. And that's where researchers are looking to policy as a guide, as a hook.
Is there anything wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that at all.
I mean, that's a fair requirement, isn't it? You should be able to say, look, this research will benefit Australia in some way for these reasons.
That's exactly right. And I think our researchers are very good at doing that. So you read those statements and you can see how they're connecting, you know, the work that they're doing at this cutting edge to the big issues of the day. So I think all of that's occurring and people are putting it into context. What I think is probably not well understood is actually how long it takes from a discovery through to an application. And unsurprisingly, there has been some research on this. And it demonstrates, depending on the field, it takes anywhere from, 15 to 20 to 30 years for an initial discovery to actually make it into making a change, perhaps to a manufacturing process or to, a nursing practice into the field and practical use. And it isn't even just that discovery. It will be that discovery combined with a number of other discoveries. And this kind of, I think, moves into the one of the areas that we could make a great improvement in is multidisciplinary research, really bringing together different types of research. The way that we have it set up at the moment, it's quite siloed. And these big questions that we face, all of the big questions we face are really complex. And this is where people with different expertise can come in and make a difference. And it will help that value add. So I guess I think about this a little bit like, and it's not a good analogy entirely, but, you know, in Australia, we're used to being successful by digging things up out of the ground, sending them overseas so somebody can make them into something and we'll buy it back.
This is not necessarily a bad thing, though. I mean, I think people criticise this too easily, don't they?
Well,
Australia is an extremely efficient digger. We're an extremely efficient digger and exporter of raw materials, and we shouldn't belittle that either, should we?
So I'm not belittling that, but I'm adding to it. What if we also did some value adding ourselves? And this gets into this research translation chain. So if we could take our discoveries and work with them more to nurture them through to that application, now that requires a much longer view and a different type of funding and support than actually what we currently have in the system.
Mm-hmm. I should say, Phil, that higher education is the largest Australian export that we don't dig up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, others might say, and I don't want to get sidetracked by this, but this, because in a sense it's another conversation, but I mean, if you look at the classic case of steelmaking, for example, Australia is one of the world's cheapest and most reliable producers of metallurgical coal. It's also one of the world's greatest producers of high-quality iron ore, the two crucial ingredients that go to make steel, and yet we can't make it here, not at a price that... and this gets back to another question which I wanted to raise, and maybe that's a little later, but that is because a lot of research, in a sense, doesn't get used by industry here for all sorts of other reasons, reasons to do with Australia's economic position.
Yeah, I mean...
And this is the reason why a lot of these things are not capitalised, is it not?
So I think there's a lot said about universities needing to lift their game in terms of translating and commercialising research.
But so does industry.
Exactly. I was going to say, not enough is said about how our colleagues in industry also need to lift their game. So Australian, the private investment in research and development in Australia is
pathetic.
Terrible.
It's pathetic.
It's dropping, right? It's sinking.
Compared to, say, for example,
South Korea, all the countries I mentioned before,
even the United States.
Israel,
United States.
So private investment in research and development in Australia is very poor, and it's getting worse. And the exception proves the rule, right? So the CSLs, the Cochlear companies, Rio Tinto, you just mentioned, miners, very innovative companies investing a lot of money in research. They're the exception, right? The vast majority. Here's the other thing. The government hands out $2.5 billion a year in research and development tax credits to industry. There's no national insurance. There's no national interest test for that. There's no public benefit test for that. That's as much as they fund the NHMRC and the ARC combined. In fact, it's a bit more probably than that. So we do have an issue with, and I think we need to take a kind of team approach here, right? I think industry and universities need to work more effectively together. And there's been some decent things, some good things done in that space recently. But I agree with Sue that, you know, we really need to take a longer term, more systematic, more holistic view, rather than every election cycle tweaking the program with a bit of culture war sprinkled over top to sort of get some things going on the basis of a party political platform. So, like I said, we're missing a holistic, systematic view of the research and development system as a whole. And I think we've got a chance, perhaps, with Minister Clare's various reviews going on, to maybe start to do that for once in the next few years.
We're talking about fixing research funding in Australia. It's terribly important for Australia's future, and we invest money in education and research, but what happens to it and how is it dished out? Quite frankly, not very well, would seem to be the consensus here. Joining us in the studio, Duncan Iverson, who's Professor of Political Philosophy at the University of Sydney, is former Deputy Vice-Chancellor for Research. And Sue Bennett is with us as well, as the Dean of Arts and Social Sciences at the University of Wollongong. Here's a fundamental question, Duncan. I'll put this to you. I've had a look at some of the ARC funding for 2023, and here are some of the projects, right? The University of Newcastle, $660,000 towards 2050, managing the recovery of Australia's coral reefs. University of Western Australia got $500,000 for research that would create software that will design safety devices to prevent traumatic brain injury. University of Technology Sydney got nearly $500,000 for a project about cyber security. Fair enough. The University of Tasmania is getting nearly $500,000 for eruption dynamics and tsunami potential from submarine volcanoes.
All sounds pretty good to me.
The University of Queensland got $400,000 for Torres Strait Islander history. Now, you know, I don't think anyone would argue it at all with any of those with any of those projects, but it does lead to a question about the nature of research. In a sense, though, you're a philosopher. I'll ask you this question. How do we interrogate what questions there are to interrogate? In other words, is there any consensus at all about what we ought to be researching?
Oh, look, I mean, I think another way to look at it is, how do we design a system so we're confident that the very best possible projects are being funded and the discipline and rigor around the assessment is appropriate? It's very hard to predict what will emerge out of research with any kind of precision, right? That's not to say that we can't assess it and try and assess what potentially will lead to good things. But it's very hard to bring most of the things that we really care about today and that make our world better that emerged out of research, we probably couldn't have anticipated. There's a lot of serendipity in research. But as I said, I don't think the game is about saying, well, should we invest more in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander research versus chemistry? I think what we should be doing is asking, how do we design a system so that we are actually encouraging and then assessing the best possible work given the people and resources we've got? Mm. I think you have to take a step back.
But they are limited, aren't they, Sue? I mean, what I bring you in here on this, they are limited. You might say, well, look, we're a small country, relatively. Mm. No, we're a middle-sized country, I think it's fair to say, with sophisticated resources at our disposal. Well, we can't do everything. We're not a country like the United States with, you know, 500 million people or a billion people in China, etc. You know, ought we be concentrating our efforts in areas where we think we can do best? Sue, what do you think?
Well, I think we actually do that quite well in the system that we have. So despite all of the complaints, I think, that we've just shared with you. One of the things that we do need our system to do is to be able to fund questions that are important to Australia, and this is really important, I think, particularly in a lot of the areas that my colleagues work in around our own history, our own culture. But equally, there are questions that are of vital importance to us scientifically, and we've just mentioned one of those, the barrier reef. And there'll be numerous. So our schemes should fund things that have an Australian flavour. The other thing to say is that Research is highly interconnected globally, and this is where Australians do very well. And there are two reasons perhaps we could advance for this. One is that our funding levels are low, and you've heard what Duncan's had to say about that. So you've got to be pretty ingenious about getting traction for your research. And so we are highly networked. The other thing is, being in Australia, a lot of our colleagues in Europe and North America look to local work. So you've got to be there, and you've got to be presenting your work there. You've got to be sort of connecting directly with people to make sure that our research is part of that global conversation. And it is, there are constantly discussions, conversations amongst research communities about, you know, what are the most important things now, even in all kinds of areas of specialisation, maths education. So I'm looking here, there's some maths education research that's been funded, and it's really around, you know, what are the key questions now in contemporary, you know, mathematical knowledge and understanding, and how can we improve that? So we're always effectively kind of pushing each other collaboratively and competitively.
Duncan, I've often asked researchers, I said, well, look, don't worry about the ARC. Why does everyone get obsessed about the ARC anyway? Go and get money from elsewhere. Go and get money from donors. So go to companies that might be interested in your work and get them interested and get money that way, because that kind of private donation, or go to private equity funds and say, look, you know, let's do it this way. And they shake their heads and say, I wouldn't even know where to begin. Is it a lack of imagination on behalf of researchers themselves, who are so wedded to the ARC treadmill every year that they don't look elsewhere?
Look, it's a great question, and there's lots to say about this. So the first thing to say is researchers are actually diversifying the sources of their research funding now, more so than ever before, for a couple of reasons. One is philanthropy is a really significant area of growth in Australia. It didn't used to be, right? Australians, I think it was assumed that Australians wouldn't sort of donate to the same extent that, or give to universities to the same extent that they do in the US. That is changing, and that's certainly something we've seen at the University of Sydney. So philanthropy is becoming more and more important, and that's fantastic. I mean, the numbers are quite spectacular. There is more funding now being generated by researchers from their industry partners. As I said, let's go back to where we started, though. We have a rather sort of weak base for that in Australia, and that really needs to improve. And finally, researchers, as Sue was saying, are, you know, ingenious in sourcing funding from other sources as well. So that is happening. But don't forget, the reason why it's important to have national funding schemes is because, of course, companies and donors have very usually quite specific interests in funding the research they're funding. Mm. And they're not necessarily going to fund all the things that are important to Australia and that are important for us to pursue.
My recycling plant more efficient. Why can't you develop some bacteria that will eat this kind of plastic?
And that's okay. We need that work too. But you need to have a diverse funding system whereby you've got strong funding for your core research capabilities, you're building a research workforce, you're investing in the big questions that take time, as Sue said, to really have a crack at. And at the same time, you're encouraging and enabling good relationships to be developed between researchers and industry, and not just industry, community, government, and also philanthropists. And that is an exciting thing that's happening now in Australia, and we need to help our researchers navigate that world more effectively. That's on us as much as it's on anyone else.
Do you think the national conversation, Sue, about research is improving in the sense that, as you rightly say, a lot of research doesn't bear fruit? Not necessarily. I mean, some of it may never bear fruit, but a lot of it may not bear fruit, as you say, for 20 or 30 years. But it's vital that we do it. There's a lot of, I mean, I've spoken to researchers who say, I can see no practical benefit for this research whatsoever. However, we don't know how this works, and I want to find out how it works. Who knows where that may lead us?
And we know that some of the great applications have come out of these unexpected findings. So researchers have set out in one direction, and through the course of experimentation, you know, if that's the nature of their work, or, you know, a chance discovery, then something else actually becomes more important. And I think the other thing about discovery research is you should be slightly, you shouldn't be 100% confident that you can do it, because otherwise you're not really pushing it. So we're in this space where it's an area of importance. We've got the skills to push at this boundary of what we know. And yet we're not entirely sure what we're going to discover. And sometimes the discovery that something doesn't work is actually just as important as finding out that something does. And now I'm talking about, you know, more in some of the applied social sciences. You know, we can have ideas that this thing works, and we may even be doing it in practice at the moment, but in fact we're completely misguided, and we need to discover whether it works in the way that we think it does to the same effect, or in fact we actually need to be doing something else.
Just quickly on this one, Phil. You know, think of Einstein. Einstein said that quantum mechanics was like crazy, insane, and yet it's probably going to form the basis of the next set of computers that we use. Quantum computing will feature the industry. So, you know, you just never know what things are going to emerge. But we also have to be careful not to instrumentalize everything. And maybe this is a slightly paradoxical thought, right? Human beings ask questions about the nature of things. That's partly who we are. That's how we're sort of wired. And a culture that values that, and a culture that invests in that, not endlessly, and there's always limits, I think is doing itself a disservice. We're missing something as a culture, as a society, if we don't actually create space for our best and brightest to ask those questions that nobody else is asking, in part just because the question is hard or beautiful or difficult, not because it's going to spin out necessarily into a company or into a product, as important as those things actually are.
Yes, actually, I was thinking the other day, because we were reviewing a book about penicillin. Actually, if you wanted a classic example, actually, because I think people think, probably in popular thought, think, oh, penicillin was invented from the ground up. It wasn't.
No, it wasn't.
Penicillin came about because someone looked at an earlier research paper that looked at molds and thought, there's an idea there, and it was from that idea that penicillin became. So I mean, it's a classic.
Yeah, I mean, that's
it's a classic instance, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about how we fix it. If it's no good, if it's no good, Sue, what do we do about it?
Well, I think one of the questions here is how ambitious do we want to be, and I'm thinking about sort of my observations over the many years is that we've looked at what needs to be changed, and we've made some changes incrementally. So we've sort of added things on, maybe we've taken some things off, we've tweaked things, and it's shifted over time. You know, I think the kinds of action that the comments that Duncan and I are leading to is a sort of knockdown rebuild, like a wholesale change to arrive at, you know, a system, which I think is the kind of vision that that we're trying to put forward is, you know, something that's holistic, that's systematic, that does address the fundamental question of what is research for, or what different types of things is research for? What can it be, and what work do we need it to do for us? So, you know, that's the kind of big picture question. And then, you know, there are these obvious things that I think that we need to do, like reduce the burden in the system. These cost burdens and time inefficiencies, and this over bureaucratic, you know, way of making decisions, and that's, you know, not even to get to the point of how do we depoliticize it? How do we?
How do we do it?
Well, we can.
Do we take it out of the hands of politicians completely? That'll probably politicize it even further, won't it?
Well, one of the things that is open for discussion is, you know, the ministerial veto. That's been raised multiple times. There's obviously the national interest test. It's looking at the ways the system is vulnerable to politicisation, and, you know, potentially making a decision that actually we do think there's enough expert input already, and that actually those recommendations are rigorous and sound.
What do you think, Duncan?
So look, a couple things from me. I mean, I, as I said before, I think we've got a chance to look at the system as a whole and to understand that there's different components, basic research, applied research, industry and private research, and ask what do we want from each part of the system and how do we join those different components together? Mm-hmm. We haven't asked that question. As Sue said, we've been sort of poking away at it. I think the first thing we need is to reinvest in basic research. It is crashing in this country in terms of the investment we're making. Universities do about over 90% of it, right? So that is really a critical part of the system that's under enormous pressure. And that's a part of the system which, over time, will pay huge dividends. Just about any study you want to look at shows that for every dollar you put into basic research, you get about 10 bucks back at some point downstream. So I think Australia needs to invest in basic research in a significant way. The Americans are doing it. The Israelis are doing it. The South Koreans are doing it. Even the Canadians are doing it. So we need to really look seriously at that, understanding that there's always budgetary constraints. I think the point about depoliticizing research is I think we really do need to sort of take it out of this political cycle, being realistic that it'll always be politicized to some extent, and let's set some long-term goals for the research system. So, for example, you know, maybe we do need to identify some big, hard questions that we want the research system to help us address, like, you know, clean energy, like social inequality and coral reefs. Or coral reefs, whatever. You know, let's have something akin to, you know, that intergenerational report that they do for the sustainability of the pension system. Let's think about the sustainability of the research system over time and build some, you know, some reasonable bipartisanship, understanding there'll always be debates and there'll always be issues that will emerge. But let's set some long-term goals for the system as a whole. And then finally, I do think we need to sort of think hard about our early career researchers. You know, we've got over 60,000 PhD students in the system. There aren't going to be 60,000 academic jobs for them. So how do we help them both be able to contribute to our search endeavors and give them more security, get them out of that precarious situation that so many of them are in, but also make sure that there are options available to them that aren't all sort of linked to being in a university. So how do we get our companies, our community organizations valuing the scientific, the sort of cultural value that these young researchers bring to the country? That's a really critical issue.
I agree, and I think this is a systemic problem in Australia because we talk, and governments are talking, you know, talk a lot about increased productivity, etc., and almost never do we talk about the woeful lack research into money invested by private industry into research and development. They just don't in Australia in a way that they do elsewhere.
Yeah, and as I said, I think...
Why is that culture developed, though, do you think?
Well, look, good question. I mean, I think it's partly got to do with the way the Australian economy works. It's not a very complex economy. Having said that, you know, people often point the finger, as you rightly said, at mining and say, we just dig stuff out of the ground. Interestingly, a lot of our mining companies are quite sophisticated when it comes to technology and innovation. But, of course, there's not as many jobs and there's not as many opportunities.
Yeah, as I said, I think I said before, we're very good at digging stuff out of the ground.
I mean, we've got to shift away from that. But so I think it's partly to do with the fact that our economy is not as economists say, it's not got the level of complexity it needs. So we don't have the kind of leadership in our economy that says, how do we become more innovative and how do we take advantage of this extraordinary generation of graduates from our universities to help us do that? And then equally, I think the universities have a job to do to create those pathways and to give students the skills and opportunities to say, hey, I can move between academia and industry, or I can take my skills out into the world in different ways. And I should, as I said, when I say industry, I don't just mean, you know, companies, you know, the government departments, community organizations, all sorts of different firms and organizations out there.
1-300-800-222 is my number. Lines are free if you want to grab one. If you are a researcher, you'd like to join this conversation, give us a bell. Let me throw a cat amongst the pigeons here and ask this question, Sue, and to you, Duncan, get responses from either. If we were able to fix the research funding situation in Australia such that universities didn't have to chase funds from elsewhere, might it be something in Australia's favour to make the sector smaller and yet better funded? than it is at the moment. You said we're training 60,000 PhDs. There aren't 60,000 jobs for
there are more than enough jobs for them. The question is whether there are 60,000 academic jobs for them. I think
There certainly aren't. Yeah, no. Yeah. Is there an argument, though, for saying we should concentrate the quality of academic research in Australia, do you think?
Oh, look, yeah. I mean, look, it's a really good question. I think it is time that we pose that question. I mean, my own view is I think there should be greater diversity. We've got, 39 universities. Many of them look very similar. Many of them are sort of doing similar things. There's been increasing diversity in the system just because funding has been so tight. So I think it's a good question to ask, how do we get more diversity into our university sector? How do we allow people to focus on things that they're really good at and have, a kind of competitive advantage and have the capability to really develop? You need to do that, though, from a position of strength rather than sort of crisis, right? You need to do it from a position where you're saying, what's good for the country? What's going to actually lift the country's benefit from doing this? What's going to deliver good outcomes for the country? But there's no question that right now, the way that universities are filling the gap between what they get for funding research and what it actually costs is basically having to go out and find that revenue from other sources. And that unquestionably is distorting the system somewhat. Mm. So we do have to tackle that problem.
Sue, what do you think? Is there some merit in arguing for a smaller, higher quality sector?
Well, I'm going to come at this from a different angle because I think there might be some new ways to think about this. So I often hear people say, we need to have a kind of critical mass of people in one location in order to be able to really push ahead in a particular research area. One of the things that perhaps COVID has taught us and helped us with is this idea of co-location. So I'm in a national research centre funded by the ARC, for which I'm, very grateful to be a part of. And we have six universities working together in this national centre. And it is somewhat of a revelation to work in a way that's really networked but not be co-located and even in the same institution. So this, one of the challenges I think in the sector is that there could be more kind of cross-collaboration in ways that are really promoted and supported rather than universities necessarily competing against each other. And we do because we have a marketplace. And while, as Duncan says, many of our universities do similar things, We are always competing against each other. It makes it sometimes difficult to join the areas of expertise and get people working together in a really collaborative way. That is a different way of thinking about the challenge. A new approach where there's more security of funding, so there's basically less kind of squabbling over and chasing after money. That may be a way to really leverage off what we have.
I mean, another way I think Sue's exactly right. And one thing I think the government could do is put a premium on collaboration, right? Mm. So if we go back to that point that Sue made earlier about the importance of multidisciplinary research, which I completely agree with, and also think about those big, hard issues that the country is facing, not only to do with clean energy, but, social disadvantage and, thinking about the future of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, constitutional recognition, et cetera. I mean, how do we incentivize our best and brightest to work collaboratively and together on those questions and in a way that makes, delivers the best value for the investment we make in the system? But as I said, you want to do that from a position of investment and strength and not from a position of, basically freaking out or through a crisis because the system is falling apart.
Mm. Georgie says on the text line, the absolute key in research is who holds the key? That's what taxation is about, people. Really, not that long ago, governments actually funded universities and set up government entities like the CSIRO, CSL, etc., and some not very clever government sold these entities that we paid for with our taxes. Clever? I don't think so. Short-term government, short-term thinking, so not in the national interests. Paul says, in many respects, the research funding issue may be well associated with a lack of need to change, seeing that we're so profitable at selling natural resources. Yes. Yes, well, exactly right. What's a message to researchers? Duncan and Sue, maybe Duncan, I'll start with you. What message would you say to researchers, given the given how broken the system is?
Oh, look, I mean, I think I'm the eternal optimist. I mean, I think one message is just the amazing work that our research community is doing, despite all the barriers we put in front of them, is pretty impressive. And every day, you know, I'm blown away by the work that's being done. I think this is a really auspicious moment. I mean, I think we've got a review of the ERC. We've got a bigger core discussion.
Is Jason Clare going to do anything about it, do you think?
So,
or is
this
it, or
is
like
the question.
So many politicians.
This is the question.
Will he commission a report which will just gather dust?
Exactly. So how do we draw together these different reviews into something really significant and substantive? I think this is a great agenda for an ambitious reform-minded minister, and I hope Jason Clare is that kind of minister.
Sue, what do you think? Do you think Jason Clare is going to make any difference at all?
Well, I like Duncan, I certainly hope so, and I'm also optimistic. I think this is a moment actually for the Australian research community to step in. There's a lot of work to rebuild trust in the system, and I think we have some very good signs. I think we need to be encouraging, and we need to be part of the conversation to say that we are here. Researchers are so deeply committed to their work. That's the thing that drives them. So they don't, you know, they're resilient. They don't give up easily, and they'll often, you know, come back to things. So we do have to continue in that vein, and we do have to look to and celebrate the success that there is there, and nurture that and continue it.
Yeah. Okay. Does that? Some people have argued that that part of the problem is the publish or perish the culture of universities, which is probably true. That criticism, isn't it? Although turning that around, given how entrenched it is internationally as well, maybe almost impossible, isn't it?
No, it isn't impossible. It's a fair criticism that universities, I think, can take too narrow a view about what counts as excellence for research, that it's only about publications or citations. But again, that's changing, right? So now we look more and more at the impact people's research has. We look at where their research is making a difference, whether it's in a journal or whether it's in the community or whether it's in through government reports or whether it's through social media or elsewhere. I mean, at the same time, that concept of publish or perish is linked to this idea of peer review and this idea of disciplinary excellence and disciplinary expertise. And you don't want to lose touch with that completely, but we do need to pluralize the way we think about research excellence, and that's happening. And I think that's a good thing.
What do you think about publishing or perish cultures, Sue?
I think it has changed as well. So globally, I think there's been a definite push towards quality over quantity. So it's not about the number and the number of papers you produce. It's about, as Duncan says, the impact that it's having, and also these other forms of research dissemination are now being noted. They're being recognised and rewarded. So writing for the conversation, things like that. They're not things that used to be.
They weren't regarded at all. Once upon a time, if you came on a program like this and talked about your research and went back to the university and said, well, that's part of my contribution, you would be sniffed at.
Yeah, those days are over.
And now it's absolutely celebrated. And I think it goes back to that kind of compact that we have. Public money goes into this, and researchers do want to have a conversation and to be able to talk about what it is and what they're finding. Now we've found more ways to do it, and we've found more ways for that to be recognised as an incredibly valuable activity.
Just one final thought. Is it so bad that Australian researchers go overseas anyway? They have to, don't they? Duncan?
Oh, look, I mean, as Sue was saying, we're an incredibly globally networked bunch, so that's always going to happen. The thing I worry about is we don't want the system to get so degraded that our very best...
People think they have to go.
...think they have to go. We want to keep, and not only keep, but attract... the best people here.
A bit like in the late 60s and early 70s when creative people thought that there was no future for their creative industries unless they actually left the country and started elsewhere. That's changed. Although the world's a big place and there are many exciting people to meet and discover.
Absolutely, and we want to keep that circulation, that global network flowing.
Anyway, been an interesting conversation. I dearly hope Jason Clear does a review does amount to something. Perhaps the old cynic in me says the odds are against it, but let's hope. Sue Bennett, Dean of Arts and Social Sciences at the University of Wollongong, thank you for your time, Sue.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great. And Duncan Iverson, who's Professor at the University of Sydney and was Deputy Vice-Chancellor of Research there. Duncan, great to talk with you as well.
Thanks, but my pleasure.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.